pattern area, because of the fact that you could really, and running after, you could come down on themselves if they have enough legs, or if they use another refueling, you can come around the last step. And therefore, you were defended on by what aircraft are based in continental Western Canada or United States. And to get enough warning and get them up to do a job there is pretty close type of operation. The Americans did extend the dew line out along the Aleutians, and they ran airborne radar patrols from the Aleutians down to Hawaii. But the airborne patrols were not 100% by any means. Bomark is one of the things that got off on the wrong foot completely in public presentation. At one stage, the Americans had about three problems, I guess, on an anti-aircraft missile. The Germans had anti-aircraft missiles during the war, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
The Americans played around with adapting those. After quite a bit of development, they came up with Bomark as the best missile for this sort of installation. The Army came up with their Nike, which is a close in. You have to defend with Nike pretty well right at the target.
Mm-hmm.
The Air Force wanted something that would go out long range. So Nike is a ballistic. It has no wings. Bomark is a little airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And they had plans and deployed a lot of Nikes around American cities. And they were going to put Bomarks in a ring from the southern part of California up the west coast, across mid-continent, down the east coast. And by this time, they've gone through Nike Air, Bomark A, built some of them. They have developed some trouble. All these things always have trouble. And by the time they got a B model going for them, the missile gap descended on them. So they started to cut back and put more of their money into developing missiles. And the deployment of Bomark went, they first of all cut out the two coasts, or just covered the most likely path of approach. And then they cut out the west coast. So the Bomarks now extend from Lakehead, Duluth, up around through Canada. If we wouldn't in it, they were going to deploy them south of the lakes.
Mm.
By putting two in Canada, you didn't cost you any more Bomarks. You defended with defenses with pretty well the whole industrial Ontario and Quebec, and tied in with down near Boston and then down the east coast. So the main concentration of Russian bombers is based in western Russia, not in the eastern side. And they would, their approach routes would transit this area.
Well, surely the Russians must have had bombers by this time. Now, I don't know. I may be talking right through my hat.
But wouldn't they have bombers that could fly, shall we say, from southern Russia and go right around the world and come up the bitter end of?
Not bombers. The bomber... business. I guess the average bomber that's flying today can go about 2,000 miles with a full bomb load, bomb, and come back empty. Now, every time you go beyond that, you refuel it in the air.
Oh, boy.
Which is a very complicated business because you have to have your refuelers forward someplace where they can intercept the bombers, generally both coming and going.
Yeah.
So, both Americans and the Russians, perforce, were compelled to make about half their bomber force, I guess, tankers, it still is not a very simple or easy operation.
Yeah, so they do that. So that they would be safe on the basis of having the most of the rigs up in the northern basket in brief, insofar as their own continental defense is concerned.
Oh, yes.
Now, yeah. I gather, too, that the Bomark Sage bases were pretty well offered to Canada on a plate. We contributed to them and to their construction and this, that, and the other thing, but I had thought myself that we had to go after the States and said, and you know, more or less say, please, may we have some bombers? But I gather this was not the case.
No, this was the Continental planners, Canadian and American, NORAD, who said, first of all, this big ban, coast to coast, and then reducing it as the money was pulled away from it.
Mm-hmm. There, we're on again. Incidentally, somebody mentioned a year ago something about perks. Wasn't very complimentary. And I suppose I've been working with him for a little while and got to admire many of his qualities, bon santé. But I've wondered about it. And the term he used, he said that, what term was it? He was unimaginative. Now, I'm not too terribly sure what he meant when when he said that. Later, I've been, yesterday, for example, I was having a long talk with John Swetnam, who's doing the biography of General McNaughton. And I've been talking to various other historians. I used to work at the historical section under Colonel Stacy. And most of these chaps were very much...
What stage was this?
I was there from 51 to 54. Helping to get out the army history, and my field of expertise was in the Normandy landing. I had never been in the Normandy landing. I was a D-Day Dodger down in Italy, you know. But this is aside from it. John Swetnam, talking about McNaughton and all that sort of thing, was going along telling me very things, quite frankly, I didn't know before. But one thing I must say that did emerge was that McNaughton was far more politically conscious, I think, than Perks ever dreamt of being. I look upon Perks myself as a fairly straightforward, forthright, soldierly thinking man who sees a thing that needs to be done and at least tries to do it. And if it's militarily sound, he doesn't perhaps even think too much and cares perhaps even a little bit less about the political consequences. I may be wrong here, but this is the impression that's coming through.
Undoubtedly. Unimaginative? I suppose if you say that he was not possessed of great strategic gifts as a soldier. He was a soldier. I have the greatest admiration for him. I think he's one of the finest men that I've had to do with. He likes people and really genuinely likes them.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it. He is not very facile in his mental processes, I suppose. Stubborn. A good fighting man must be stubborn, I guess, to a certain extent.
Well, I think now, looking back on it, this was a year ago when he used this word unimaginable. He went on to say, yes, no, that's not that. He went on to say that a person like him, or not like him, but indeed anyone like him, to win the VC, the DSO, the MC, you know, I mean, God help my soul, he was a ruddy tiger in the war.
Mm-hmm.
That an imaginative person couldn't do it.
Right.
And maybe he has a point there, I don't know.
Yes.
But on the other hand, from the information I've dug up about him during the late 30s and during the 39, 40, 41, 42 and whatnot, he was one of the best training officers I've ever had. He was far ahead in his military thinking with respect to mobile war. It was he who planned the first combined ops on the West Coast that was ever held out there when he was G1. He went through the various staff courses, etc., at Camberley and elsewhere during the 20s and 30s, always with flying colors. He's not dumb.
No.
But I can also imagine that he would get hold of an idea, and once he latched on to it, it would be like something like a bulldog.
Yeah.
And a British bulldog at that, I don't know. But I gather, too, that another one of his problems, and probably your problem, this would be not unique to him, was that during that period, and later, there's always the tremendous difficulty that you're faced with respect to arms and equipment, be they ships, be they aircraft, or what have you, that just as soon as something is off the drawing board, it's almost obsolete. There's something coming up behind. It cost you millions of dollars to build something, and then bang, somebody's coming up with something better.
Yes, indeed. That's one of the reasons why things take so long to get and cost so much, because you keep modifying them as you go along. You keep thrusting the frontier of knowledge and capability back and trying to incorporate that knowledge in the weapon that's in hand at the moment. And there comes a time when, after all sorts of, this is always a battle between the engineers and the operators. The operators always want it right up to the minute. The engineers want it frozen and not changed, so that they can produce it. This was Mr. Howe's great stand.
Yeah. There's one thing that surprised me. Possibly it shouldn't. To look at Burks and to hear him, and when you consider his background, born in Britain, he still has quite a British or quite an English accent, went to a British public school,
he did fight and was in the Canadian Army and all that sort of thing. But he always looked to me, the older pictures I see of him, as the epitome of a British officer, you know, beautifully dressed and ordering his uniform from England and whatnot.
Yes.
British to the teeth. And yet he seems to have got along with the Americans exceptionally well and admired them a great deal. I find that, perhaps I shouldn't find this odd, but am I right?
Well, I think it's a measure of this business of being somebody other than just the bulldog breed, that he has not closed his mind on the
he never got around them, as far as I know, and you can correct me here, a group of advisors. For example, one hears from the Americans and sometimes from the British that, a beautiful example would be, to my mind, Horvalisha having Little Heart as a very close advisor to him during his period of office, for the most of his period of office. Were there any group of men around Perks, people that he knew, people who were forward-thinking and all that sort of thing, to whom he would turn for advice?
He didn't. Look for that sort of thing. He was a little... some signs of his basic thinking was that he wanted to he felt the army was organized and he wanted to have one brigade in the east, one in the center, and one in the west. Completely prepared to sort of wipe aside the fact that this was a very poor deployment. It was all right for housing because the housing happened to be there. But if you have your troops scattered all over the place like that, you can't ever exercise them. You can't bring them together. You can't train your officers at anything other than a sort of battalion level unless you go through great and expensive generations. He wouldn't... listen to anything other than this, so this way it should be. You were quite often surprised that he would go away with somebody like Churchill, go out to Winnipeg and announce the formation of a unit out there that nobody had ever heard of before, this was... There was Churchill was interested in some Fort Garry horse or something like this that had been his old unit and hadn't been done right by it. They were involved in all of it. You pick up the paper and read that this had been done. He tended to that sort of operation, but sporadic type of operation. Generally, if he had a problem, or if he thought it was a problem, or if he didn't like what was coming up, he would... get together with the departmental advisors by himself. He wouldn't have any support from secretaries of his own or advisors other than from within the department. This is one of the operations that he never could really understand about the American system.
Mm-hmm.
He would go down there. He would see the Secretary of Defense with thousands and thousands of staff, running really almost a fourth force.
Yeah.
Redoing, rethinking, recomputing most of the things that the services did.
Would this have been an advantage?
Had he done so?
And again, I'm not necessarily thinking solely of him, but even now, perhaps. Or previous to birth.
One of the great advantages that I always saw out of this so-called integration was the fact that you could make a single staff, and the minister was not faced with three conflicting recommendations. Not recommendations of to fight or not to fight, but recommendations on sizes and importance and roles and equipment of the three forces, because to run a modern armed force is a constant increasing cost operation. The tanks that you bought during the war for $17,000 were $100,000 when they became the Centurion, and now I guess they're about $1 million if you buy the latest idea. Now this goes, when you have limited funds, you are, the minister is inevitably faced during the planning and budgeting cycle with proposals by the three services that are generally at least 50% more than he has a chance of getting money for, and short of a dire national emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to, by some device, cut this figure down to what will fit the Treasury Board's estimate of what is possible within the economic climate of the time. So that for a man behind a desk to judge of this is just impossible. Mr. McNamara and the Americans have solved it by a great staffs that make assessments on their own on cost effectiveness studies, or a thousand and one ways that they grope to decide whether they need more ICBMs or more pentatomic divisions or more atomic carriers or what. With the alternatives that we faced, we either had to give the minister some help by the way of staff like this, or we had to retool the military staff so that they came up with military a military plan instead of three.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this didn't mean that you just came up with one plan to the minister. You could come up with alternatives, setting out the staff's ideas of what the virtues or weaknesses of each of the alternatives were, and go over with them with the minister, and play them that way. But he was not sitting in isolation from the military staff, either alone as the minister, or even with a big group of people redoing everything that the military were proposing to try and assess its value. So, I would say that in Mr. Perks' was a little too unquestioning about some of the military proposals. He needed and could have used help. Not that he didn't have some, he did.
Mm.
But on the face of it, he was a man for armor, and if the army came up for more armor, he would buy it like that.
Mm.
Things that he wasn't for were the end of the line, and they were the first things lopped off when the cut down, the budgetary cuts were made.
Mm. He put more money into the Air Force, did he not?
Oh, he inherited a situation where the Air Force were committed to size and equipment programs that he really couldn't do very much about for a while.
But I remember even while he was in a member of the opposition, that he seemed to be always in favor of increasing the air strength at the expense, if need be, of the other two. The speeches that he's made in the House always seem to lean towards the Air Force.
Right from the build-up, well, as a result of World War II, to a certain extent, the Air Force, having undertaken this great training plan, very expensive training plan in Canada, was always the largest drain on the defense budget.
Mm.
Their equipment's expensive. They were in the line of sort of Canadian public feeling is for the air. So they were sort of a popular service. And he inherited the condition where the Air Force was about the same size as the Army, but with very large and expensive equipment problems. And he carried this on, except with his exception of the Arrow, and he
I think the Arrow would be the exception, though, wouldn't it?
Yes. And the chiefs of staff were pretty well unanimous that the Arrow should be canceled. This was not a decision that he forced on.
In a number of things that he did, or that had to be done, perhaps, might be a better way of putting it, I don't know. He seems one way or another to have roused up public wrath. The decision... Now, mind you, the opposition, the Liberal Party, made good use of it. The decision to scrap the Arrow. Well, you can always make political hay out of this, no matter what side of the house you're on. NORAD, by which one can make it appear that we are slipping more and more under the influence of the Americans. The atomic bomb lack of decision, shall we say, which wasn't the fault of Perks, but rather the fault of Dietrich, but nevertheless, your opposition could point out, as it did in the elections later, that we have the rockets and all we have to put in them are bags of sand or something like that. The twin keys, is Deacon Baker's twin keys to what? According to Perks, Deacon Baker never did know what the hell the twin keys were about. But nevertheless, these measures and the other one, the reduction... or the change, shall we say, of the militia's role to
through the civil defense, which roused up a great many of the honorary colonels and the rest of it, resulted, it would appear, in a quite a hostile press.
I suppose so. One of the most sensitive areas that he operated in was exactly this business of the militia and turning them into a civil defense organization. He never had really very much use for the militia. I think to a certain extent that was a hangover from his experiences as a regular officer between the two world wars. The militia was the one reason for the existence of the regular force at that time, because we were still government policy was to maintain really the permanent force as a, not a fighting force, but a cadre from which the militia would be mobilized. And many of the people in the permanent force felt this was wrong and that the militia was a bent reed on which to rely because they weren't efficient. They couldn't be efficient. They didn't give enough time to it. And I think that he brought forward some of those attitudes with him as he, when he became minister. They're not popular attitudes.
No, yes, no.
Because militia are voting, community, significant people.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Well, I get two different versions of this idea. And which one is right, I don't know, and you may have a third, who knows. One is this, and it seems to me that this is the... I'm not sure if you gave it to me, but... One was, first of all, that in any major war that may break out, the forces in being, the trained forces in being, are the essential thing. This, of course, means your regular army. And if one goes on the basis of a major war with atomic weapons and all that sort of nastiness, the role of the militia, the traditional role which saw it feed a Canadian expeditionary force, well, there just wouldn't be the time anymore. And therefore, they were a useless expense. But if one could change their role into that of national survival, it would give a raison d'etre of the militia once again. It would keep the old units intact. It would give them a completely or partially significant role in society, and everybody would be happy. Now this is, this being so, ergo, let us make them into a civil defense. We don't have a decent civil defense. The militia will be happy to continue into existence and so on as that. I mean, one can see the logic just rolled out like a carpet. This may be true. Now, another angle that was presented to me was that the Department of National Health and Welfare, who had civil defense, wanted to get rid of the damn thing. They thought that the armed forces was the logical place, and I'm given the impression that they sort of shoved it over to national defense, had them accept the responsibility and the financial care of it, and were quite happy. And it sort of is given as a, or at least it was presented to me in the form of a one-upmanship by the Department of Health and Welfare over National Defense. Now, are either of those right?
The first one is the right one. The operation of health and welfare. The problem of civil defense is a complex one.
Mm-hmm.
It really is everything from managing the economy to providing intravenous injections for,
yeah.
for mothers having babies. So that there is an aspect of most government departments in civil defense, transportation, communications, health, fiscal management, the whole thing. It started out in the Department of National Defense. The Department of National Defense ran into this multiplicity of interest and said, here, this, we can look after some of it, but not this. This should be a government agency of some government-wide operation. Well, nobody did anything of that, and we screamed about it enough that it went over to health and welfare. Health and welfare took on some retired service people and started to go about certain aspects of the job, but they also ran bang into all the things where health and welfare were completely at sea and had no know-how or no authority or no responsibility. And therefore, they then changed it to back to a management really under the...
Help yourself. Where's your glass?
It's right here. Help yourself.
I'll just have a...
A committee of all things under the Privy Council, which is recognizes the sort of complicated nature of civil defense, but of course it puts it under a committee, a committee of one of the bete noirs of any patient administrators. And now I think it is largely over under under Department of Industry, chiefly because Bud Drury is there and he took it on. I'm damned if I... So the history, if somebody wants to write up the history sometime, the evolutions of the civil defense is...
Well, now this, I remember,
to be very interesting.
About that time, I've seen other people. It's around about that time I was finishing a history I wrote of the Canadian Scottish Regiment. I knew a lot of militia officers. I still know a lot of militia officers. They were rather hot under the collar with that. But some people have said, on the other hand, that this was one of the major contributions of George Perth's term of office, that he recognized a need. That he was the first one really to take civil defense seriously. In other words, if you were going to plot and plan and spend tens of millions of dollars on aircraft, missiles, this and that and the other thing, in the expectation of combating an atomic attack, and at the same time take no precautions for civil defense, that you're really just whistling up a tunnel.
Certainly should deal with the problem in the round, not just have one side of it. On the other hand, you get into such awful complications and mental blocks, almost, that there isn't a country in the world that has a good civil defense program. We're not the only ones. We're not the worst by any circumstance. George did take this step. Realigning the militia in this particular guise. And I think he did it, without any malice at all. I think that he thought that this was the right thing to do. On the other hand, it was immediately jumped on by Mr. Diefenbaker, and the first thing he knew, it was an unemployment relief operation where we took in thousands of people into the militia in that winter as to teach them to be civil defenders and just get them off the unemployment rolls. Mm-hmm. And this irked everybody in the thing, because it was another one of those dodges that you were using a thing for. And this didn't do the new role any good, because it soured everybody on it before they really had a good chance to make it work.
That's right. I remember that now. It's funny, I'd forgotten that. And I can remember in Victoria seeing people coming down dressed rather sloppily in a uniform, coming back from their civil defense practice or their, was it 100 days or something of that nature?
Yes, full-time inspection.
Yeah.
Thousands of them.
And Harkness, I believe, dropped it very...
Well, Harkness was... he is a militiaman. And responsive, therefore, to all the thrusts of maintaining and making the militia better.
If you were to sum up, looking back, the major contributions of Perks during his 3 years in office, what would you say they were? Or are they?
I wouldn't want this to be quoted at all, because I think he's one of the finest men I know. But he was not a good Minister of National Defense, chiefly because he wasn't a politician. The major role of the minister is to weigh the advice that he gets, go before a cabinet and argue for what is needed. George didn't do either of those very well. He gulped some of the things, and he was not a good cabinet man in the sense that if he felt, having looked at it, having had the advice of this, having all his experience, he decided this should be enough. He shouldn't have to stand and argue with some of the people who were pretty good arguers, like Donald Fleming and the rest of the people in the cabinet. What you want, and you don't get it very often, is a very persuasive advocate for cabinet debate. You can, I think, because nobody can help you there. You are alone. You don't have a staff. You don't have an advisor. You have to make your point. I think a reasonably good administrator for the department, in the sense that he can, a feeling that he, for what he can get out of the civil service, plus this business of being good advocate. Mm-hmm. And George wasn't that. George was still a military man, among military men, and he needed to be more than that if you want to military advice, there's all sorts of it. You don't need to have your own, be your own military man.
Telephone? Could you pardon me?
I was just looking at our tape, and I only have about two more minutes on it.
Well, before you turn it on again, I would go to war with George with more confidence than fucking anybody I know. I think he's a wonderful personnel man. People like him. He carries people with him. But he was not a strong minister of national defense, just because his human qualities didn't lie in this business of bargaining and dealing with people across the...
Yes, I can appreciate that. I still think it'd be true today as it was 10 years ago, in my mind.
I was trying to think of the name of his aide that is now in external affairs.
Oh, yes, I've heard of
Dick,
him. I've heard him called Tricky Dicky.
Yes, Dick. Canada. What the heck?
No, I think he's over in Geneva now.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But quite frankly, various people with whom I've talked have a very poor opinion of this chap.
Anybody who speaks for the minister and kicks people around ends up in that position of the people he kicks haven't got very much. He made people, he was very cocky little man just out of London School of Economics, I think it was.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And completely new and strange to the department and to the thing with the military.
Mm.
But he lived and went with the minister steadily for every hour of the day for those 3 years. And
he's a man to be contacted.
It might be, if you had an opportunity there, be worthwhile. Worked for a short time.
Oh, the first chap, the fellow from Shawnigan Lake School?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's out there. I'll be interviewing him.
Might be useful to talk to him. He wasn't dug in at all. He just came down and started into the thing. And headmastership, I think, opened up. And then he went back there like that.
Miss Kingsbury.
She has been sort of the principal clerk in the Department of National Defense for donkey's years, and she retired a year ago, I think. And she has seen all the ministers come and go, and
you don't remember her initials, by any chance, do you? It's just a